July 1, 2003. And committee, we're going to be looking to have the work session first on Senate Bill 903, then we'll have a work session on possible introduction of speaker-approved bills. Then we'll just go down the rest of the agenda as it's printed, Senate Bill 190, Senate Bill 854, HM 10, and HM 9. So, with that, just for some brief introductory remarks, we can open up the work session to Senate Bill 903 and ask Tim Nisbet to come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and we very much appreciate your prompt action in scheduling this bill, which just passed the Senate yesterday. And I'd like to call your attention to the workers sitting behind me. Three of the four of the persons sitting behind me in the front row are facing the loss of their benefits this week. This will be the last week they collect benefits unless we can get the extensions enacted proposed in 903-A. They're among about 9,500 workers who have been out of work for more than a year now and have been looking assiduously for work and unable to find it, who will lose their benefits this week. And we may see that number increase by another 15,000 workers by the end of September if we, as the Employment Department predicts, trigger off of current federally funded extensions. In the memo I've distributed to you, I display on the back of that the somewhat now complicated scheme of unemployment benefits available and how workers move through those different entitlements and how much is paid by the state and how much is paid by the feds. What Senate Bill 903-A does is continue some of the state's effort in regard to extensions, both for the long-term unemployed, for dislocated workers enrolled in retraining programs, and eventually, by the end of September, creates a fallback 6.5 weeks when we're expected to lose a program which is now funded half by the state and half by the feds. So there's a 13-week extension in this mix, which is funded 50-50 by the feds and the state. If we trigger off of that, Senate Bill 903-A has a provision that says we create an added benefit there of 6.5 weeks. So that's no additional cost to the state, since the state's paying half of the 13 weeks right now. All told, these benefits will cost the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund about $47 million over the next 2 years, which is well within the margins. The margin that would trigger a rate increase in either 04 or 05 is $182 million. So we're able to say with confidence, based on the Employment Department's number, that this will not trigger an increase in employee payroll rates in 04 or 05. Obviously, the need is great. I think we're hopefully we're at the worst point right now in terms of the height and duration of unemployment. Upturns are predicted by the end of this year, early next year. We hope that comes to pass. This at least keeps those workers who've been having to, in many cases, sell their homes or sell their cars to kind of keep to stay in Oregon and keep looking for work here. We'll keep them here. As you probably heard from earlier testimony this session, a lot of these workers were not only in manufacturing, but in managerial jobs, professional jobs, high-tech software engineers. All are among the victims of this recession. All have been unemployed for long periods of time. They're all looking. They're all hoping to secure new employment. This extension will enable them to continue their job search and kind of keep ends together as they do so. So we would hope that this bill will get your approval today and can be expedited just as quickly on the House side as it has been on the Senate side. I think this is the one last bill you're going to be dealing with this session having to do with unemployment, and we hope it can be expedited. Thank you very much.
Questions? Mr. Nesbitt, the folks from AOI couldn't be here today. Have you had
any? AOI supports the bill, Mr. Chair, and we have, at this point, there's been no opposition expressed on the record by any organization. The Employment Department Advisory Council, consisting of both labor and business and community representatives, has unanimously endorsed this approach as well.
Okay. Further questions? Okay. Thank you for testimony.
Thank you.
And since we are in work session on this, what's up for us?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of Senate Bill 903.
Move
it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 903 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, it's a a very sad situation that we're in, that we need to consider a bill like this. But it's also unfortunate that we're in a situation where we can do so under the kind of terms that Mr. Nesbitt has described to us, and I hope we'll pass it and send it on to the floor.
Okay. Further discussion. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to support this bill. I would like to say, however, that I wish that I were voting that this many jobs were going to be created.
Ah.
That would be very good.
Yeah.
Further discussion. See you none. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye, and chair will carry this bill on the floor.
You have co-carriers on this. They've done that before.
They have. The Senate had a Democrat carrier, so we'll have a Republican carrier on this side.
Okay.
With that, the 903 is passed the floor with a due pass recommendation, and work session Senate Bill 903 is closed. We will open up work session for possible introduction of speaker-approved bills. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Legislative Council draft 3697 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Flores has moved Legislative Council draft 3697 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Any objections? If not, so ordered. And we'll close the work session and we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 190. And we have Janet Atkins joining us as the administrator for this bill. And let's see, Mr. Douglas, can you come forward? And Dave Fiscom as well.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Rob Douglas representing the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association, here before you today in support of Senate Bill 190. We believe Senate Bill 190 will streamline the Board of Maritime Pilots' procedures for setting rates, pilotage rates, and for that reason we do support it. A lot of hard work has gone into this bill. Not only do the operators support it, the people who pay the rates, but the representatives from the various pilotage grounds support it, and the board supports it. We've worked long and hard with the Department of Justice and the Public Utility Commission. We think it's a good bill, and we urge its advancement.
Okay. Mr. Fiscom?
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, Dave Fiscom, my client for the purpose of this testimony is the Columbia River Pilots. I should tell you that I also am free for this limited purpose to speak on behalf of Tom Gallagher from the Bar Pilots. Tom is in a different hearing room at this instant and otherwise would be joining Rob and me at the witness table to advocate for Senate Bill 190. This is, in every respect, a consensus bill that comes to you after a route that included Senate business, Senate ways and means, Senate floor. Now, your committee, we would encourage you to send this on. It achieves a very important purpose, and it is very limited in its scope, and that is by design. That purpose is to allow the Board of Maritime Pilots access to the experienced Public Utility Commission rate hearings officers. And again, it's limited to just that rather than to all proceedings before the Board of Maritime Pilots that require hearings officers. I should add briefly that in developing the concept that appears before you today, we did spend some time with Representative Shetterly out of acknowledgement of his interest in the general hearings officer panel and our attempt not to violate the intent of that. And it's with his permission, perhaps better word, acquiescence, that we are here today and present this consensus bill to you. Mr. Chair, either Rob or I would be pleased as well to make some brief comments about the amendments when you're ready for that. I think you have two in front of you, and so I will take my leave from you as to when you want us to deal with those.
Okay, I'd suggest maybe we go ahead with the Dash A6 amendments.
I think you have before you two amendments that achieve a similar purpose. The A6s go a little farther than the A7s, I believe. And Janet, your counsel can help with this because she has seen these perhaps for a few moments longer than we have. But the A7s are conflict amendments, and the A6s include, I believe, the conflict amendments as well as one other provision that was inadvertently omitted in the bill's route to your committee, and that is the removal of a section of the current ORS, ORS 776.115 sub 8. The language to be removed is on the A7 amendments, page 3, starting at lines 18. Current language requires that all rates, as language says, all rates and adjustments thereto shall become effective on the same date specified by the board for all pilotage grounds, which means that if there is more than one rate proceeding underway, if one is completed, that completed rate proceeding has to wait till the others are completed, and it seemed to those who drafted this bill that that did not make any sense. It made more sense for the rate proceedings once decided to be able to be implemented immediately rather than to wait artificially for another deadline down the road. And that the removal of that language was something which could have been, perhaps even should have been, in the original Senate Bill 190, was not, and so we propose to add that today. Thus, we're here to advocate the A6 amendments. Lastly, I should say that in the room, if there are questions, are Susan Johnson from the Board of Maritime Pilots, the director, and David Hatton, the Attorney General, who's responsible for the board, and he can add perspective to questions if you have them, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Rob Douglas again. We also support the A6 amendments.
Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I do have one question. On the back page, it says the administrative law judge and board may receive and consider recommendations made by the Economic and Community Development Department and the Port of Portland. I'm just kind of curious about the Economic and Community Development Department. What recommendations would they be making under the hearing?
That's removed.
Or the rate hearing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, I believe that is existing statutory language that was put in some years ago.
I think
the language is also permissive. It doesn't necessarily require that.
Okay.
Well, and the A6s take it out.
No.
Don't they?
Mr. Chair, the A6s, if you look on page 4, the lines 6 through 8 are current law, which is left in. And that is, as Mr. Douglas has said, existing law that allows for comments to be made by either the Economic and Community Development Department or the Port of Portland. And I know that from time to time the Port of Portland does have an interest in commenting on such proceedings as those that are underway. And so that is existing law which is continued.
Further questions?
I'm reading the delete, but I'm not reading the fact that the language is actually in the amendment.
Right.
Okay.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Johnson, you're signed up to testify. Do you wish to testify?
In the day of 7th Street.
Good afternoon. Susan Johnson, Administrator for the Board of Maritime Pilots. I only signed up in case we didn't have any of our constituents here to testify on behalf of the bill. The Board does fully support the bill and the amendments.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Very good. Thank you. Seeing no one further on the witness list for Senate Bill 190, we'll close the public hearing and Senate Bill 190 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 190. In fact, either Mr. Douglas or Mr. Fiskin, I need you back in to talk about the Ways and Means referral. One of you? Oh, here are you. Just to clarify that there is no need for the Ways and Means referral on this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bill was actually considered by Ways and Means on the other side.
Okay.
And it was somewhat surprising it didn't go back to Ways and Means, but we're happy to be here.
Okay. Thank you. So we are in work session. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 190 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Oh, wait. That's right. We still have to adopt the A6. Sorry.
Dash, strike that. Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the -A6 amendments.
Representative Flores moves adoption of the -A6 amendments to Senate Bill 190. Any discussion? Any objection?
No, I don't have an objection.
Okay, seeing none, so ordered. Now, Representative Flores. No, we're not doing the A7s. The A7s are incorporated in the A6s.
Okay. Now, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 190 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Thank you, Representative Flores. Has moved Senate Bill 190 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and that the subsequent referral Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion? Representative Monsignor.
Mr. Chair, maybe this should have been done with public testimony. It says the number of hearings and expenditure, and then expenditures, they're unpredictable, but the expenditures have ranged from $18,000 to $84,000 in the last few biennia. And I was just wondering how many more hearings or would this require or is that even relevant? Anyway, it looks like there will be a cost, and I just saw that now.
Let's see if we have a response to that.
Sure, members of the committee, the number is going to vary depend on whether or not somebody files for a rate hearing. It's just, I think, that simple.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Douglas. Further discussion, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This issue, I think, came up as a result of the consolidation of the hearings officer that was done several years ago. This bill, as I perceive it, is simply a fix to get the Oregon Board of Marine Pilots back into a situation where they have knowledgeable hearings officers, so they don't have to retry every single issue in front of hearings officers who are extremely competent but are not familiar with the area. So it's a great bill. Just a quick comment on Representative Morris Anderson's question. These little boards have extremely varied expenses based on what their caseload happens to be in any given year, and it's really impossible to predict what that might be except by past experience, which may turn out to be wrong.
Okay, further discussion? Okay, seeing none, call the roll, please. Zanetta? Can we call the roll?
Aye.
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 And the chair votes aye. And any objection to put this on consent calendar? Seeing none, ordered. And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 190 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 854. And ask Senator Beyer come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9. Here today on behalf of Senate Bill 854. For those of you who would like to see my file on, it's probably a little more significant than your file on 854. This bill is an issue that was brought to my attention getting close to 2 years ago now, that when the discussions first started to happen about commodity commissions and the court decisions that were coming down on commodity commissions across the nation, none yet in Oregon, I might point out for the record. But, and then most recently was the case in Washington State with the Washington State Apple Commission. What this bill represents in front of you is, no one can say it will be a bill that will protect us from all lawsuits. We cannot guarantee that if sued, we will win the lawsuits. But what this bill is what the Department of Justice and what legislative council and the administrators of the commodity commissions, the boards and directors of commodity commissions, have all decided as a group that this is the best defense we have with today's history of court cases behind us. So as the person who in the Senate, as vice chair of the Ag and Natural Resources Committee, I am the one that worked with both the Commodity Commission groups and the Farm Bureau and other producers and came up to the bill you have in front of you today. Is it perfect? I hope so. But, of course, we'll have to wait for the courts to decide if it's perfect or not. I would point out that not all producers support the bill as is. There are some producers who want all commodity commissions to be required to offer refunds for their marketing, at least, if not for the entire program. What we did is, when we're working with the different groups on this bill, was we agreed to say, okay, on a commission-by-commission basis, right now you can decide if you want to offer refunds. And if you do, we'll put you in a separate part of the bill. And we, all 28 commissions went out to their people, asked the question, and three of them came back and said, we want to have the option of offering refunds. So what you see in this bill is three commissions, three of the 28, who have opted into that section. The rest, the other 25, as commissions, chose not to do that. They said, we're happy with the way it is. We want to take our chances that way. The problem you have in offering refundability to all commissions mandatory that way, to make them all do it, is you've got certain commissions that are controlled by the producers. And the producers, if one or two large producers, and in the case of the Fryer Commission, I think there are only two processors of chickens in Oregon. If they decide they don't want to pay into a commission, they will actually get rid of the commission, even though the chicken growers, the people who raise the chickens, may want to still have commissions. So that is the issue you come into if you try to go a mandatory refundability option for all producers. As an attempt to deal with that and to make sure that the commissions are working with their producers, we put in the bill that all the commissions have to do a survey of their membership and make that survey public so that we will know 2 years from now, if the issue is back in front of us then, where the producers are. We don't just have to listen to the lobby or the individual commissioners or the commission administrators telling us where they think their producers are. There will be surveys will be done as part of this legislation. Another thing we did as part of the compromise to get people to agree with the bill was to sunset certain parts of this legislation. Specifically, we're sunsetting the piece of the public member added to the commissions, and secondly, sunsetting the increased oversight of the Department of Agriculture of the commissions. By sunsetting those two provisions, because there are still court cases working their way through the court systems across the United States. There have been court cases so far decided at the district court level or the appellate court level. The Ninth Circuit Court was the latest one, of the Washington Apple Commission. But these will be working their way to the Supreme Court. So these sunsets are in March of 2009 is the day we picked for sunset. And that day was very, very carefully and negotiated, I will say, because the people on one side that wanted a shorter sunset, the people on one side wanted a longer sunset. We chose in March of 2009, knowing that if there's any problems or unrest in the producer industries, they will have to come back in the 2005 or 2007 session in order to get that taken care of, because if they wait until 2009, it will be almost impossible to get a bill drafted unless all parties agree in the 2009 session. So what we've done is we picked a date that doesn't signal to the courts, we hope, that we're not serious about this by putting out 6 years, but yet forces the people to come to the table and stay at the table to talk about the issue and come back sooner if they see fixes that people can agree to. And I think that was the reason we chose that date. Mr. Chairman, I think it is a good bill as crafted. I would urge you to pass the bill with no further amendments. All major agricultural groups support it as is. When this bill was in front of the Senate Ag and Natural Resources Committee, it was about a four-hour public hearing with people coming in on all sides of the issue and airing it. We've addressed as many of those concerns as could be and still keep everybody on board. So I would be happy to answer any questions, but I would just urge you to pass the bill without further amendments and give some certainty to these commodity commissions as they are trying to go forward to help agriculture in Oregon, which, as we all know, is struggling with enough issues. We don't need this one also. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Senator? And Representative Barnhart, just as a preface to that, too, my plan is to move the bill out today if we can, so be as thorough as you choose to be to make sure you feel comfortable with the bill. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. You may already have said this, and maybe I was wool-gathering or trying to read the bill, but this is in response, isn't it, to U.S. versus United Foods, the Supreme Court case?
There have been, and if I can find them all, someone behind me can probably tell you how many there are, but there have been about six lawsuits that have been going through the court systems to date. As I said, I think the first was the mushroom case, and then the most recent has been the Washington Apple Commission that's been decided.
We're going to hear from some other people, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
We are. Thank you. Thank you, Senator. I appreciate that.
Senator, we had a couple of folks in our caucus that have expressed some concern about this bill just generally. A couple of issues. One is that this bill actually expands government by bringing these commissions under the Department of Agriculture, and then also that there's now going to be additional folks that qualify for PERS because of this. Have you discussed those kind of issues on the Senate side?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to the best of my understanding, if you look at the fiscal statement that hopefully you have on the bill, and I do have it, there are not going to be additional people brought in as state employees by this bill, to the best of my knowledge. There is an increased oversight of the Department of Agriculture for the commodity commissions, but what that consists of is approval of budgets, and specifically the marketing part of the budgets, most notably, because in order for those to be considered public speech, so they're not subject or they're not in violation of the First Amendment of the Constitution, we have to have an increased oversight by a state agency of those budgets. When the original bill, originally as drafted, and I'm sure you have that in your file, under that scenario, I think the Department of Agriculture, the fiscal on that was approximately 3 or 4 FTE in increase. We, in the negotiations and through all the different amendments we went through, we had that reduced, and we actually passed the -5 amendment, so we had a lot of different things we discussed, but we didn't print that many amendments because, as you can see, it's a very large bill. But we reduced that to, I think, I apologize, I don't have the fiscal right in front of me, but I think it seems like it was either 0.5 or 1 FTE.
And our
administrator has that information in front of her.
Members, in your staff measure summary, you can note the fiscal statement right up top shows minimal fiscal impact by this bill.
So, okay, thank you. And okay, thank you. Because I must have the last. No, this is 190. I'm sorry, up the right bill. I see. I thought there was a little bit more than that on. I do not believe that we are going to be adding, you know, many government employees because these commodity commissions all already exist. They all function with private citizens running their boards. Most, if not all of them, hire private firms to run the commodity commissions. And what is going to happen here is just going to be increased oversight of the budget by the Department of Ag employees.
Okay.
Good for the question. Representative Barnhart.
Just to be certain, it sounds like what you just said was that commissions will continue to contract with outside companies to do management services for them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that will be a commission-by-commission decision as it is today. That won't change, and I cannot see any reason why. There's nothing in this bill that forces them to do something different. If commissioners on, you know, you name the commission, the Oregon Trawl Commission, for instance, wishes to change services, they would probably have the option of asking the Department of Ag to come and pay for the service to run their commission. But it's still, that all those decisions be left to the local commissioners.
Mm-hmm. But then,
follow up?
Well, I'm not sure who this is the right person to ask a question of, but I'll throw it into the air and see who catches it. In order for a PERS position to be opened up, that's a legislative action, isn't it? For us to open a line for a position.
Mr. Chair,
if one of the commissions wanted to hire somebody as a PERS employee, they would have to come back through the Ways and Means process to do it, wouldn't they?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, these budgets are currently not looked at by the legislature. If the Department of Agriculture wanted to come on and put on some additional people to start running commissions, they would have to come back to either the legislature or the emergency board to get the authority to fund those additional positions.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
Further questions?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll go to my rules committee.
We have two other House members here to testify, and they have some different issues here, but we've not yet been presented with the bill by the proponents besides Senator Beyer. Representative Kropp, Representative Nelson, I'll leave it to you if you want to come up to testify now without the committee having the benefit of having to walk through the bill yet. You're welcome to do that.
I have a 2 o'clock conference committee. I can come back later, perhaps, if you so desire. I'm assuming you probably have worked this bill by the time I get back here.
Okay. Why don't you come forward?
Yeah, come forward.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17.
Go ahead.
And I am here to lend my tepid support to House Bill 850, or Senate Bill 854, and I'll qualify the word tepid. You have in front of you, I think, some -7 amendments that I have brought forth for your consideration. You know, I'm a fifth-generation Oregon farmer and have long believed in the value of commodity commissions. Now, I've seen with my own eyes for many years in the peppermint business that was the only way we were ever able to achieve some very important research that was essential to keeping our industry going for many years, but also in helping us continue as a minor crop to have the tools necessary to manage our crops well. And by tools, I mean some of the herbicides and pesticides that we had available for many years that because of the FIFRA Act of 1996 caused them to be re-registered for minor crops. Very expensive. We lost a lot of tools because it simply wasn't cost-effective for certain chemical companies to go ahead and spend a tremendous amount of money to do all of the work again to re-register those certain chemicals for minor crops. So we lost registrations in those. We used commodity commission dollars to convince the government that we went ahead and did those tests and those trials ourselves. And it helped us maintain some of those very important management tools that we had. That's the value of a commodity commission. And that's what this whole thing's about, is commodity commissions are for growers. They're paid by growers like me who grow fescue and peppermint, grass seeds. I pay an assessment. It's not something that I have any choice about. But I do that, and I don't squawk about it, because I know that it directly benefits me. And most of the farmers I know are like that. And that's the value of a commodity commission. Well, today, commodity commissions are threatened because, in large part, of the United Foods ruling. Now, I've become convinced over the last year, a few months, that I've been agonizing over this issue, and I am. I'm deeply conflicted, and I will tell you that, because as a farmer, I like it just the way it is, and that's pretty typical for farmers. On the other hand, change is being forced upon us, and so we have to be willing to go down that road to some extent. The question is what is the proper policy in response to the United Foods ruling? And I think Senate Bill 854 gets us most of the way there. In its current form, I will tell you, it is not my opinion that it will survive a legal challenge that is certain to come. Now, that's really that frankly is a matter of interpretation. Legislative Council doesn't know if Senate Bill 854, I've had a long conversation with them over the lunch hour, in its current form, will in fact survive. They think it is crafted to have the best chance of survival to a court challenge. And I think that's an important distinction, because it clearly has elements in it that I think meet the requirements of what the United Foods ruling prescribes and what other current on-appealed cases have been discussing. So I think it gets us there. Does it get us there all the way? I'm not sure that it does, and that's why I've offered you the -7 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moss Anderson.
Could you explain what the United Foods ruling is?
Well, to the best of my understanding, without being a legal scholar or a person who has, and there are certainly people in the back of the room that can talk more clearly about it than I can, basically, commodity assessments are used for a number of purposes, research, for promotion. The Peppermint Commission, we use most of our dollars for research, not a lot for promotion. Other commissions use most of their funds for promotion. It's the promotion piece that centers around the United Foods ruling. What occurred was, as I understand it, basically the Supreme Court said, based on a legal challenge, that it is a violation of free speech to compel a farmer like me to spend my particular commodity assessment on promotional dollars if I disagree with that. Now, that's it in a nutshell, as this farmer understands it.
Follow up?
So if there was a farmer who really wanted to promote his own product, and it would cost quite a bit of money, this refunding stuff, is that what the issue is?
Okay. Precisely, Mr. Chair and Madam Vice Chair, that's exactly what the issue is. It's refundability. If the Sustainability 54, as it currently is configured, allows an exception for three of the commodity commissions only, who chose this as part of the negotiations that Senator Beyer talked about, allows them not mandatory refund, but rather refund authority. So they can choose at some point in the future, if they had a member come forward and said, you know, I really think you ought to, I disagree with how you're spending my promotional dollars, I really think you ought to give me my part of that money back. They have the authority to do that under Senate Bill 854. -7, basically, my amendment says, why don't we extend that to everyone? And the reason I say that is because I think that offers us a more defensible position in court to defend this entire concept. I will tell you that my -7, in my opinion, does not create a bulletproof scenario from lawsuit. I believe we're going to get sued anyway. And my whole point for bringing it forward is I think it helps us just prepare for the best legal defense that we possibly can in this issue. Because I think without mandatory refund, and we've been put on notice, we'll be sued. So if Senate Bill 854, which doesn't have a mandatory refund provision in it today, if it goes forward and is passed and signed into law, it's my belief we will be sued, and who knows where we end up. The proponents in the room here will tell you they think it will pass the constitutional requirements and legal challenges. There are others who believe it will not. There are others like me who, frankly, are not sure what it's really going to do. And my whole point in bringing the -7 amendment forward was that it gives us perhaps a little better legal position. And that's my only reason. The bill needs to pass, and it needs to pass in a timely manner. And I would encourage you to pass it in some form. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me go back to the promotional part of this. In other words, there are a whole group of many, many commissions that belong. And so there's a promotional effort, and I have my money in there, but I decide I don't like the tack that they're taking, so I want my money out. Do I benefit from the rest, the other 7/8, in their promotional efforts, because they're going to go under Brand X promotion, which obviously people think include me. And I'm wondering how mandating my money back and I still get benefit makes that fair.
Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, that's an excellent question. because that really, I think, strikes at the heart of the issue as to why mandatory refundability is not part of Senate Bill 854. Because I will tell you from my own personal experience that that very scenario in some commissions will evolve if that is part of what occurs. Let me give you an example. In the ryegrass country, which is kind of south here, South Valley, where I'm from in the Harrisburg, Halsey, Albany area, we grow a lot of annual ryegrass. And there's a lot of my family's heritage, religious heritage, called Mennonites that are part of that. They don't vote. And if it wasn't mandatory that they pay taxes, they wouldn't pay taxes either. And that's part of their religious heritage and their belief system. I think you would have a circumstance, perhaps in the Ryegrass Commission, and I think Dave Nelson could speak to the what I'm talking about here. You would probably have a scenario where if mandatory refundability was part of it, you could possibly end up with half or more of the members of the Ryegrass Commission choosing not to have their dollars used for promotion, or if you had mandatory refundability for every aspect of or all of your assessment dollars, they would just, in essence, pull out of the commission.
Sure.
And then the rest of us who believe in the commission, who are paying our assessments,
exactly,
are going to providing them a benefit that they're not paying for. Now, that's inherently unfair, and I think that's why we've had mandatory assessments all along, for that very reason.
That's right.
The problem is here is that in Senate Bill 854, we've granted three commissions the opportunity to decide for themselves if they want to offer a refund. It isn't mandatory refund. They have to make that decision themselves. And my point to you is, if it's good enough for those three, it ought to be good enough for everybody. And that's my point.
Yeah, and to that issue, too, members, we'll get a little more thorough understanding of the court cases on why the mandatory refundability, or why refundability is even an issue now. So, and we'll get that discussion a little later.
But again, Mr. Chair, I would like to reiterate that the Dash 7 amendment that I'm proposing is not a panacea, is not a cure-all from a lawsuit. In my opinion, we will still be sued, even if you adopted the Dash 7, just because I don't think it meets the opinions of those who disagree with the direction of this bill entirely.
Further questions? Thank you,
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Representative Nelson. While Representative Nelson comes forward, our administrator can make a couple of comments on the actual bill that's before you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The differences with the Dash 7 and the bill and the mandatory versus just giving a commission authority for refunding is in Section 22 of the Hay and Gross bill on page 9. And Senator Beyer referred to three commissions that are given authority to offer refunds. This is not mandatory, but they have the authority to. And it's the Alfalfa Seed Commission on line 28, the Oregon Grains Commission, and then later in the bill is another commission. But the Section 22 is what differs from the Dash 7 amendments because all commissions are given the authority in the Dash 7 amendments, not just those commissions.
Thank you. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and distinguished members of the Rules Committee. It's nice to be here before you, and I appreciate this opportunity, and I likewise appreciate being able to talk after a period of not being able to do so, but this is a very important issue to me, and when people say, why are you involved in this, you know, from the very first time of hearing about Senate Bill 854, it has been a source of amazement to me why we are even in this business of preparing Senate Bill 854 based on what I understand. In the last session of the legislature, those that, who were here recall the Blueberry Commission issue, and it was one of those where good Representative Ben Weston said it was the first time in 12 years that anybody had overturned a vote, a predictable vote on the floor, and I was able to speak on behalf of an Amity blueberry farmer as well as represent the other growers in the blueberry world. What had occurred is that the Blueberry Commission was assessing rates higher than the blueberry farmers could afford. And what had been asked was that there be, you know, a look-see at those rates. And ultimately, there was not, so it resulted in a court action. And then Phil Ward, if you recall, from the Department of Agriculture, decided to preempt a court decision. And unfortunately, since he's not here today, we can't say that was the reason why, but when we voted again on the bill the next day, it was because he had promised to let us, to tell us and to show us that the Department of Agriculture had indeed reviewed all rates charged by our 28 commodity commissions to see if they were appropriate. I called Director Ward in the fall and reminded him, in fact he was in a van headed to Klamath Falls for a major meeting, and I reminded him his promise to the legislature of the report and the review of the commodity rates says, and he assured me we would get them, and we never have. So it's one, I guess that's the reason that I'm just committed to this issue, because you know, the purpose of the Commodity Commission, since they were first established, I think it was wheat was the first one established back in 1947 or something like that, was to bring together those who are in that business to maximize the marketing arm of the wheat growers. And indeed, that does sound like a prudent thing. Now, first we would think, as we think of commodities like apples and other things, well, how on earth do you generate the money for these rates? Well, I think what's amazing is that if you considered, for example, apples in the state of Washington, by just a 25-cent charge, and I do have those notes somewhere here, on a box of apples, they generate some $23 million with which to advertise, you know, the great apple growers of the Northwest. So my point in saying that is it can become a substantial sum of money that most of us who are no longer in the ag business are aware of. I have before me today a letter that I would like to share with you. You've received a copy of it, and to give you the appropriate background like Representative Monty Sanderson asked for, if I could just hit some highlights of this letter, Representative Doral. If you would look at this letter, this is from the attorney, Brian C. Layton of Clovis, California, who has brought all of these legal actions regarding the assessments and the, quote, free speech that should be a part of the commodity commissions. He starts off by letting us know that he represents a sizable group of Oregon agricultural producers who are absolutely opposed to this bill if it does not allow a refund provision or an opt-out with respect to mandatory assessments. So this is where we were 2 years ago. We asked the Blueberry Commission, now why can't, in this case, Mr. Olson just pull his money out of the Blueberry Commission and, you know, go market his own blueberries the way he wants to, since he was going to go broke if they continued to raise, you know, the rates. Unfortunately, we didn't get an opt-out opportunity. And it's my understanding there really is none. You know, it's we're in the clutches of a commission. And incidentally, the commissions are supposed to be governed by the growers. I mean, not by Oregon Department of Agriculture or others. You know, the growers who put the money in should have the say-so, just like any organization, whether it's the Lions Club or, you know, JCs or Siroptimus, according to the same concept. And when the fee gets too large, you know, you do two things. You find other ways to fund your fees, or you quit the organization. Well, that's, in this case, because you don't have a say-so, that's why various agricultural producers now want the opportunity to opt out of the commission. Anyway, as Mr. Layton understands the purpose of this Senate bill, he believes it's Oregon legislature's intent to make our commodity commissions more like state agencies, so that those commodity commissions and the Attorney General's office, General's office can claim that mandatory assessments for speech-related purposes is government speech. But Mr. Layton explains it's not going to work, and if this bill passes without an opt-out provision for dissenters, it'll be attacked by him on free speech grounds. And also what they found is that we do not have general membership from the public in our commissions, which would be required, and this is one of his issues. He explains, and you'll see there in the third paragraph, I believe.
Representative Nelson, I hope we're not going to read through the entire letter.
No, sir, we're not. I'm going to highlight that you will see that the many actions that have been brought that are in paragraph 3 have all been brought by this attorney, and that's why I felt there was credibility in using him as a reference. So basically, my concern is that the growers in our 28 commodity commissions maintain and sustain their right to free speech, that their voice should be heard in any type of marketing campaign, and that should they feel that their voice is not being heard or that it's more expensive than they can afford, that they have the right to opt out. We do not need to establish 28 more government agencies, which would then require the governor's oversight and management.
Can you explain or show me in the bill where we're establishing 28 new agencies?
27. I mean, well, we have 28 agencies, five of which I believe already are appointed, have officers appointed by the governor.
Where in the bill does it establish new government agencies?
It's a quasi... establishes existing agriculture commodity commissions as state commissions, except Oregon Beef Council, Oregon Wheat Commission.
Okay, so the commissions are already established, is that correct?
But as state commissions, not commissions of the growers.
Okay.
As state.
Okay, so...
And also their oversight, excuse me,
Chair. Well, take
your
point, if you're saying that that's
Chair
your
girl.
Point... If that's your point of the 26 or 27...
There are 28 total commodity commissions.
That point is taken. Thank you.
And it also provides for their oversight by the Department of Agriculture, which is a state agency, requiring more action by a state agency rather than themselves discipline themselves.
Okay.
And there are three other commissions, as I understand, the alfalfa, the wheat, and the beef, that have chosen to keep their own organization at this time, as is.
Do you have anything further?
We do not want in this case, the state can impose guidelines and rules and administrative rules for operating these commissions.
And when you testified on the Senate side with this, that wasn't an issue to them?
No, I did not testify on the Senate side. I did not.
Oh, okay.
I did not do that.
Okay. And have you...
I wish I had.
Have you expressed these concerns to the lobby members that have been working this bill?
I have. And my concern is that at a time in our lives where our purpose should be to resize government, we do not need to be bringing in additional agencies over which we need additional people to provide the oversight and auditing and all those activities that we want as we give some concern to their budgets.
Okay. Well, and hopefully you'll have a chance to listen to the rest of the testimony, and those concerns probably will be alleviated. Any other questions, Representative Nelson?
Okay. I do have here, and I'm guessing if others know that you have this bill, the first individuals we talked with, and we have polled all the commodity commissions.
We have polled?
My office yesterday polled all the commissions. There are many individuals who did not even know this bill was coming up.
So it's no different than the Blueberry Commission issue of which you served on the committee in the last session, too. People who don't know about it, you know, it's difficult to expect them to be here to protect their positions.
Thank you. Mike Dewey and John McCulley and Chuck Craig.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start. Mr. McCulley has provided a handout. Mike Dewey, representing a consortium of the commodity commissions, the 28 commissions. Mr. McCulley is working on this bill, and then from the director from the Department of Agriculture, Chuck Craig. I guess I will change what I was going to say, and I guess we'll just try and get into the to the meat of the matter here. First of all, I want to thank Senator Beyer and Senator Shields for working on the legislation and seeking what was a contentious issue, a well-crafted compromise. And Representative Doyle, thank you for hearing this legislation today, because it is legislation that we need to pass, because if we do not have the various commodity commissions, we take immediately $10 to $12 million out of the Oregon economy, and obviously you have some multiplier effects. About $2.5 million of that is at research at Oregon State University. So Representative Krupp is right. Our opinion is we need to pass a piece of legislation for the natural resource base for economic development in the state of Oregon. So let me say, first of all, and Mr. Craig can correct me if I'm wrong, when we first started talking about this legislation, the last thing we wanted to do is have significant additional government oversight. And we had always wanted to say that the commodity commissions would be protected based on the advice of the Attorney General. And they are experts in this. They have looked at this for about a year and a half, looked at all of the cases, looked at what other states have done. As a matter of fact, as you know, the Apple Commission was put out of business for a while, and that had a significant impact on that particular entity because they were acting unconstitutional in terms of the free speech argument, because they look more like a trade association as opposed to a state agency. And Representative Nelson is saying, well, we really don't want these entities to look like a state agency, but they have to look like and act like a state agency if they're going to be able to collect the money and spend the money. They have to be under the umbrella of the government to have the government speech. Otherwise, the First Amendment protections are not available. So we sat down and we talked about these various issues, and we looked at this issue and we said, we don't think you need two or three additional FTE because you're already doing a lot of this. And so we have a minimal FTE. Actually, you know, my assumption is there's not going to be any FTE because the Department of Agriculture is already doing this. These are already state agencies, like it or not, and they have to be state agencies because that's the way they can only collect the mandatory assessment. So let me talk just a little bit about, first of all, the compromise, and then I'll talk about the refund issue. The Farm Bureau came in with some amendments that we as Oregon, the Commodity Commissions, disagreed on, and some that were very good ideas. And we reached an accord on the survey, the oversight. We agreed on the public member, and many people think it's a good idea to have a public member on a commodity commission because it adds a different insight, it adds a different way of looking at things. Other organizations, commission, have those, and it seems to make sense for them. And so by educating and talking to people, most of the commissions felt very comfortable with a public member. As a matter of fact, the lawyer from Clovis said that this is something that is not in the bill. It is in the bill. We do have the public member provision. And so we did reach the compromise, and we do have the survey, which will go out between now and the next session, and the survey is about refundability and whether or not people want refundability within their particular organization. Mm-hmm. Having that will tell us more about what they think about that organization, and if they want to come back, there's an opportunity to come back in the next session to offer refundability. Now, one of the things that we did, and Representative Shields asked us to do this, for each commission, what did they do with regard to outreach? How did they communicate with their producers so that producers knew about this legislation? Now, we have some producers here today who will testify in favor of the bill, but obviously, because of the hearing and the quickness of this particular hearing, we couldn't get an awful lot of people here. A lot of people had to work. But nonetheless, this is kind of commission by commission, the meetings that they had, the newsletters that they sent out about this legislation. So the organizations, the commissions, did a good job of providing for that particular outreach. So now let me talk just a little bit about the refund provision. We do not have a mandatory assessment in the state of Oregon. Excuse me, we do have a mandatory assessment. We do not have refunds. The wheat commission and the wheat league did a survey where there are some states on the wheat side, the commissions, where they do have a voluntary refund. And it's in the range of 10 to 30%. And so it's very difficult to know what your budget is going to be, in particular when you have contracts, and you may have three-year contracts, or in fact for one of the commissions that John works with, they actually fund a scientist, a researcher at Oregon State University. So if you have your budget going up and down like this, it's very difficult to have contracts to Oregon State University or someone else, or somewhere else. At the same time, everybody benefits by the promotion or the research. I mean, clearly they benefit by the research. And if they benefit, they ought to pay into that particular situation. Now, there are, and I can understand that, there are some producers that would like to, and these would be larger producers that would like to promote their own particular brand name. Let's say it's Tillamook or something like that. And we're talking about Oregon milk, we're talking about Oregon cheese, we're talking about Oregon beef, and that's good for all the producers in the state of Oregon. And we need to keep it that way, we think. Now, we sat down with the various commodity commissions and we said, now, if you want to provide for a refund, we'll give you the opportunity in this bill. And three of the commissions said they wanted to do it. The rest went out to the producers and said, you know, what do you think? And the other 25 came back and said, no, we believe, based upon the legislation that we hope you will pass without any amendments, we can win a lawsuit. We believe a lawsuit's going to be filed. We do not know what's going to happen. But the Washington Apple Commission looked at our legislation and basically took, if you will, the roadmap of what we've done, because that they believe it's the best way to protect their particular position.
Okay. Representative Flores.
Mr. Dewey, before you get too far down that trail, from your statement, you had made inquiry into the various memberships of the commissions as to whether they would prefer to have the opt-in or opt-out provision. How wide was that inquiry made into each of the respective memberships?
Mr. Chair and Representative Flores, it would vary from commission to commission. The Hop Commission has like 18 producers. And wheat would have in the neighborhood of 4,000 to 5,000 producers. So it's going to vary. Based on, you know, we made it very clear that refund was a significant issue. And not only did the commissions have the discussion, but we had one or two meetings with just kind of an open forum with producers to say, here's what's going on, here's why you're vulnerable, and we have to have the discussion about refunds. Because, quite frankly, if we have a refund provision in the bill, there's more likelihood that we would survive a lawsuit. Now, recognize if there's a lawsuit filed against one of the commodity commissions, they're going to fund that particular lawsuit, unfortunately. It's not the general fund. It's not other funds. It would be that particular commission and their assessment dollars. But that was one of the things that Senator Shields had asked about. There are some people that say they didn't know very much about this piece of legislation. There were articles in the Capital Press. Clearly not everybody reads the Capital Press, but that's the agricultural newspaper in the Northwest. So there were many, many articles on this because, as you know, this is in the segment of agriculture and is pretty controversial. So we wanted to make sure, and what we tried to do through the Dairy Products Commission, who kind of helped us get the communication out, is make sure you do the outreach. Make sure you talk to the growers. send them information. A lot of them will not read the information, unfortunately. We know how all that works. But this is kind of a database of all the communications that took place.
And thank you. I was just trying to get maybe have some comparison level because Representative Nelson mentioned that her staff had polled some of the commissions and there felt there was perhaps a gap in the communication. So I wanted to make sure that we have it on record that you have indeed made some
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, it was my understanding that in part the good legislator was asking about whether or not you support the legislation. And of course, because of the timing of this hearing, if you ask the question about do you know about the hearing, many people would not be aware of the hearing just by virtue of, you know, it's 24 hours or 48 hours, something like that. But I think we've done a pretty good job. The Farm Bureau had that concern initially, and quite frankly, that prompted us to say to the commodity commissions, you need to make sure you do better outreach because there are going to be people coming in here saying, why are you going this direction? And we're going this direction because of two Supreme Court cases and the AG's advice.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like the panel to respond to some of the things in George Van Leeuwen's letter. I don't know if you've seen it.
Yes.
He makes the statement as a grass seed farmer that the commodity promotions have outlived their usefulness, he says, because this market is saturated and the variety owners are doing their own specific marketing. And he says that the constitutional free speech problem could be addressed by eliminating the promotional activities and just doing the research and transportation. How do you respond to that?
Representative Doyle, Representative Close, and I'm sure some others, colleagues, would have perhaps even a better answer than myself. According to the Dairy Products Commission, we have the highest per capita consumption of milk. And in part, I would say that's in Oregon. That's based on a very good commission. If we look at the grass seed industry, if we look at China, and we have some numbers, and Mr. Nelson can speak to those, a few years back it was 50,000 tons. Now it's
13 million
tons or pounds. If you look at that and the trade missions that have occurred, it's very difficult, and we have trade missions coming in all the time from the wheat side and the potato side, and these are government trade missions in many cases. So it's very difficult for private business to access, let's say, a China market because of the way the government imposes their regime or the opportunity for access. So I would say that there are some that are making progress in terms of their own promotion, but by and large, you've got to pool all the money, and having the opportunity for economic development in this state to help you, to provide access. The governor had a trade team on the seed side that went to China. So these are real opportunities, and we see it all the time. So I respect Mr. Van Leeuwen's opinion, although I don't think it's time yet to say everybody's ready to be on their own in this state.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I might go ahead and respond as well. John McCulley, representing the commodity commissions as well. I think one of the issues that we've faced in this legislation that would address directly what Mr. Van Leeuwen is saying is the significant diversity that we see in the 28 commodity commissions. And the last page of my testimony gives you a list of all of those commissions. And while Mr. Van Leeuwen may feel that that's an issue and a problem in the grass seed industry, for example, it would not work, say, in the fire industry. It would not work in the mint industry or the hop industry, just because of the diversity of the commissions we face. So trying to apply a blanket anti-promotion philosophy, if you will, across all the commissions really wouldn't work just because of the diversity that's represented there.
Thank you.
If you can talk a little bit too about the just kind of a litigation schedule. I'm kind of looking at this bill that it's a proposal that then is going to get tested in court. Then it's going to, I mean, it'll be with the circuit court for a while, the court of appeals after that at least, and kind of timing on those, that type of schedule. what you would anticipate.
Well, Mr. Chair, we have a letter that's been entered into the record where this lawyer believes they have clients or a client that is willing to test this particular statute. It has an emergency clause. And so upon the signature of the governor, it becomes law. And so we would anticipate, based upon the rhetoric, that we're going to see something very soon. I mean, that's just, it's kind of the first salvo that's occurred. And we've had a lot of discussion about this for, you know, a long time, and we can't disregard what's happened around the other states. And so, I mean, clearly we're so vulnerable because if we don't pass the legislation, we've given everybody a roadmap. I mean, we've had all these public meetings about the constitutionality of the statutes. And we've talked, and I won't dwell on this in much detail, we talked about the First Amendment and promotion, but we've got a significant delegation issue here. And I'll do that very quickly. Most of the preponderance of the commodity commissions were created by a stringent vote of the producers. And once that occurred, then they set up the assessment. And the AG said you cannot delegate that to producers where they now look like a trade association. So what we're doing is now, if you will, recreating those commodity commissions. And so when Representative Nelson talks about the commodity commissions being, you know, created, the 28, it's that we had to recreate them, essentially, because they were created, in the opinion of the AG, illegally. So that's another issue that we need to deal with, and we deal with that. I might say, as an aside, sometimes you look at the Senate vote, and this will be somewhat interesting to you. In the Senate, there were a number of people who voted against the bill that we didn't think would vote against the bill, and they said it was a protest. And I can understand the protest in that some minority commissions are not going to be funded or may not be funded because of the general fund dollars. And this is a commission. Now, these are other fund dollars. They're not general fund dollars. But some people got up and said it's a protest because of what's occurring on these other commissions. They are, I think, different. Obviously, they are funded different. They're already, you know, created. And even Senator Shields, who spoke for the bill and helped craft the compromise, said, you know, I think I'll vote against it because of a protest. So if you see that, understand that there were some internal factors that were at work that we did not anticipate.
And that helps your cause in what way?
Well, we just want you to know that there are certain dynamics around pieces of legislation that, you know, we could not perceive until Senator Gordley got up and we said, I think we know where she's coming from.
Mr. Chair, he did anticipate a question.
With that, what we would like to do is Mr. McCulley is going to explain the major changes that have taken place in this legislation that get us in the, if you will, the lawsuit-free zone, or at least the losing a lawsuit-free zone.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, John McCulley representing the Commodity Commissions. I need to point out, to make sure you understand, that the Commodity Commissions did all have to vote in their commission, public commission meetings, to have this bill introduced. They also had to vote and pass a motion in those same public meetings that they would help support the lobbying effort for this this bill. So the commissions were pretty actively involved in making sure that they were understanding what they were getting into here. I also want to talk briefly about the commissions as they exist now. It may help, or may be confusing, but I'll let you make that decision. My testimony, I've attached a matrix of what exists now for commodity commissions and what the changes would be under Senate Bill 854, the engrossed version. Commodity commissions now, as you've heard, are units of state government. They are part of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Their budgets are approved currently by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. All of the contracts they write for research, advertising, promotion are all approved by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And if they're a certain size, they're all approved by the Department of Justice. They are audited. They are subject to the state's public meetings law. They report annually to the Secretary of State's office, the annual financial report. They report to Legislative Council all the accounts receivable under the bill that was passed a couple of sessions ago by the legislature. So they do act as state agencies now. What Senate Bill 854 does is tuck them a little more tightly under the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And that is done primarily in the area of promotions. The lawsuits have suggested that that is the area where commissions are most vulnerable for the compelled speech argument that you've heard discussed is in the area of promotions. And if I can find the part of the bill, if you would look at page 11 of the bill, lines 4 through 11. This is where that more close relationship with the Department of Agriculture occurs. That section says that the department shall review and may approve or disapprove plans and projects recommended by the Commission for Promotion and Advertising. Prior to that, the department had certain responsibilities relative to the commissions, but they did not have the responsibility to really oversee the promotion activities. So this language was developed as a part of the compromise as to how it would read. So the lines 9 through 11 were actually agreed to as part of that compromise to just give Department of Agriculture more authority over how the commissions operate. You've also heard the requirement that commissions have a public member. Again, another way to address the issues that have arisen in the lawsuits. The public member will now be required of each commodity commission. And the commissions have embraced that reluctantly at first, but I think most of them are seeing that there is value in having public input, customer input, if you will, in helping them craft their promotion, marketing, and research programs. The second page of my testimony toward the bottom there lists the key elements of the bill, and I would quickly refer to the ones I haven't referred to already. Mike has talked about the survey. Again, this was part of the compromise. The whole issue of refundability was where the negotiations really took place in this bill. And the compromise occurred when we agreed that the three commissions who stepped forward would have a refundability option. The 25 commissions agreed that they would like to go with Senate Bill 854A as it is. And we further agreed as a part of that compromise that we would survey all of the growers to ask them their opinion on the refundability idea. And then the final part of all of this was a sunset to make sure we come back and look at all of this again. And that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, was a hard-fought negotiation that required give and take on the part of all the parties involved. Took many, many months of work to accomplish that, and we think that Senate Bill 854, while not perfect, as you've heard from a number of people, is a good piece of legislation that is going to move us as closely as possible to defending the lawsuits that probably will happen.
Questions? Representative Monsanto Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What if a grower does not want to be a part of, I mean, do they have to belong to the commission? I mean, could a grower not be a part?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, there are a couple of ways that a grower would not be a part of a commission, would not pay the assessment. One is if they are involved in, say, casual sales, and that would be defined by rule. What is a casual sale? Maybe a roadside stand, a farmer's market, sales like that may not be subject to the assessment. The commission itself can adopt a rule that, say, certain types of producers would not be subject to the assessment. For example, I think the Blueberry Commission just adopted an administrative rule, and someone will correct me if I'm wrong, that says that organic producers do not have to pay the assessment to the Blueberry Commission. The Blueberry Commission may be looking at performing research on pesticides that would not benefit an organic grower. So they, by rule, have that ability, and the bill provides for those types of opt-outs. A person who just says, I don't like the commission, I don't want to pay the assessment, cannot opt out.
Further questions? Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to be sure I understand this, though, because I'm not clear on why a successful program, somebody would want to have a refund. If it benefits me, then I'm going to be happy that I have paid into it. Let me just say, let's take pears. I grow pears, and I'm part of the commission. So who decides the program, the advertising, the public relations, media relations, the paid electronic? Do I have representative on the board that makes the decisions for all the growers of pears as to how we're going to market those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the answer is yes. The Pear Commission, for the Bartlett Pear Commission, is the commission in the state that mostly.
Okay, so, but there's a board, and that board has the responsibility of choosing those programs.
That's
now,
correct.
Now, if you advertise those programs and you are involved in the foreign market and you're doing value added and I'm selling more pears as a result of it, then I'm very happy with that. It would be only if you had very poor promotional programs and I thought you were wasting my money that I would want to get out of it. The beauty of everyone paying in is that you know ahead of time how you can budget what kind of money you're going to have to promote pears. So if I decide it's a good program, I'm selling more pears, you're doing a great job, but I can also get my money back. I have the best of both worlds. So I guess somehow you've got to explain to me what is the problem.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, as you can probably imagine, there are people who, how should I say this, do want something for nothing, who in this world are willing to have someone else pay for them to benefit. If not all people may be happy with the advertising program, or they may just say they're not happy so they can get their money back. There are those who are opposed to the idea of a mandatory assessment period, whether they're happy with the advertising or not. They just don't want to pay the money to the commission. So there are a number of different reasons why a producer may say, I don't want to pay that assessment.
Why did the bill go a step further and say the board of the commission can come up with pears are good to eat, but the ag department says, I don't like that slogan, I'm going to do some oversight? Why did you go that step further?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it was the belief of the attorneys who have read the various cases that brought us all to this table that additional government oversight was necessary to show that the state of Oregon was involved in providing that speech, that message to the public. And under that umbrella of government speech, the commission's messages would be protected. And so it was determined that legally it was the best defense to come more closely, be more closely aligned with the Oregon Department of Agriculture and actually have them make those reviews. The department now reviews the budgets. They see the budgets that the commissions present for their advertising. This additional step provides the added protection that is believed to exist, be necessary, right, to protect from lawsuits.
Thank you. I have one last question, sure. Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'm a member of the commission, and we all have Bartlett pears, and the promotion and advertising is going to say Oregon Bartlett pears. Is that correct? So if I want to advertise Verger's Bartlett pears, then I'm free to do that.
Sure.
I would just have my own promotional money I would have to do that. But the pool of money is strictly under the umbrella of the state of Oregon. Okay. Thank you.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I know you've got some other people. Very quickly, just to be sure, the Director of Agriculture appoints, and today already does this, but appoints the commission members. So it's not as though, it used to be that we had elections, and under this bill, the director will appoint, and this is a delegation issue, a constitutional issue, the director will appoint the commission members. And for at least the week, there are various areas geographically. The language, though, is very limited in terms of what the Department of Agriculture would look at in the area of promotion. So if it's disparaging against another commodity, they could nix the message. In other words, don't eat chicken, eat beef.
Right.
Or if it's not factual, they could nix it. If it's in poor taste, they could nix it. But those are the guidelines that the Supreme Court came up with. And that was very important because we wanted to, again, limit the oversight of a third party to stay under the umbrella of state government.
Mr. Craig, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Chuck Craig, Deputy Director for the State Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chair, I think I'll make only a few very brief comments here. The department's been on board with this bill from its inception through its numerous revisions, and we feel that the process has been a very open one. The meetings that we had after we had obtained the initial advice from the Attorney General on what some of the legal issues that we were faced with were subsequently open to the public. And the public was notified, and then, of course, after that, we had the hearings in the Senate, which were public. People had a chance to participate. We believe what we have is a good compromise that represents the points of view that the vast majority of folks have brought that has been accepted. We feel that taking this step to try as best we can to ensure the future viability of Oregon commodity commissions is an important part of this administration's program for rural economic development and to try to protect as best we can the infrastructure that serves the economy of rural Oregon. So we support the bill as it came from the Senate very strongly. I would make just a quick comment on the Department of Agriculture's role in oversight for the promotional program. I think that that's been well explained what the purpose is. The reason that we feel that this will not result in additional work or fiscal impact is we've been trying for some time to create a stronger linkage between our international marketing program and the marketing programs of the commodity commissions. This is a good venue for us to come together with a stronger working relationship in those areas. And so we were moving toward changing directions a little bit as this happened anyway, and it fits very nicely with what we were planning to do.
Okay. Questions? Representative Berger.
Why do we have three groups that are being treated differently? Why do we have, alfalfa, wheat, and grains?
Mr. Chair and Representative Verger, again, we had the discussion of refunds, and we got to the point where we said, now, if you want to protect yourself even further from a lawsuit, and if you offer a refund, you don't have a government speech issue, potentially. And so three of the entities got together and talked to their growers, and they said, we'd like in the statute to offer a refund or the opportunity to offer a refund. And so they chose that road. And we said early on, if you want to go down that road, that's fine.
Okay. Follow-up, Chair. So I'm to understand that, again, this was a voluntary thing to help you have some balance that would give you legal protection.
I can't go into the mind of exactly what they, but our advice was that if you want to get closer to 100% in terms of a lawsuit and winning a lawsuit, and the issue is all about the free speech, if you give them a refund, and so they're going to have that discussion at some point in time. The surveys will tell us an awful lot, and I suggest you'll want to ask for that information. What do the surveys look like? What are the growers saying about a refund? Once we do those surveys.
Follow up, please.
And a follow up?
Let's go back to Bartlett Pears. They pick me. They pick my commission to sue. And they don't pick any of the three. Do these three offering a refund help me in my lawsuit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you ask a great question there. The answer has to be that those commissions, three commissions themselves, will have to make those decisions, just like all the other commissions will have to decide if they are going to step forward and help the Bartlett Pear Commission, should that be where the lawsuit is filed. I don't know the answer to that, but those commissions will have to make those decisions.
Speculations.
Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I have two topics. The first one is raised by the letter from Brian Layton that was given to us by Representative Nelson, in which he talks about government speech. And maybe the first question is are we going to get a review of this line of cases so we have some idea of where the courts are going with this term government speech? Is that part of the hearing today? Are we going to hear about that or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernhardt, Richard Whitman, I believe, is in the room, who has been the chief counsel on this. The cases are starting to go a little bit better our way.
Okay.
But nonetheless, we still have those two Supreme Court decisions that kind of went like this a little bit.
Okay. All right. That's helpful, and I'll ask those questions later.
Okay.
And one other question, and I want to make certain I've got this right. This is to the Agriculture Department of Agriculture. The reason for this bill isn't really in response to this line of cases, is it? The reason for the bill really is to make certain that we do a good job with our commodity commissions of integrating with our international sales effort. Is that right? And the answer to that is yes, by the way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, the answer is yes, and in fact the bill serves both purposes.
Oh, the last part you should have left out. Thank you.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Bernie Faber. And Glenn Stoneberg, why don't you come on up, too?
My name is Bernie Faber. I want to thank you for listening to me. I'm a dairy farmer in West Salem. My sons, two sons and I, and my wife operate a 300 cow dairy right out of West Salem here. I'm currently on the State Board of Ag. I have served as chairman of the Oregon Dairy Commission in the past. My son currently is on the Oregon Dairy Commission. We support Senate Bill 854. Without any other additional amendments. I would like to possibly talk a little bit about this refund situation. Experience that I've had from the producer side is that the Oregon Dairy Commission has been operating now for around 50 years. With everybody being assessed to promote dairy products, as was stated earlier, I think we're number two in the nation on dairy consumption, number one on dairy quality, and we're proud of that, and I think these are the things that that the commission talks about. But one of the things that happens when you have a refund that certain people, anybody, you can have any excuse why you would want a refund. Maybe you don't like the programs. Maybe you just need the money. That is a very good possibility right now. People just need the money. And so they look at it from today's standpoint. But once one of those producers opt out, it allows other producers to say, why do I want to be a part of this when somebody else is riding a free ride? And we don't have that situation now. But if we allowed that refund to be somebody to have that refund to them personally, that would be a real problem down the road, because people would begin to say, and I would like to say on behalf of this, and this does not have anything to do with commissions, but I served as a chair of a program that basically was a fund, was a that looked at pricing on dairy products, and we collected quite a lot of money when prices were very low. We had 97% of the producers that were members, and we could not keep that organization together because the 3% out here were people were being a problem, and so those 3% rode along with the rest of them, and that caused a friction amongst our organization, and it went away.
Thank you. Mr. Stonebrink?
For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink, Executive Director for the Oregon Cattlemen Association, and kind of happy to be up here testifying with my neighbor who I never get to see except when I come to the Capitol. Oregon Beef Council is one of the commissions that is being discussed, and the Oregon Beef Council is made up from two segments of the beef industry, the dairy industry, which provide beef as well, and they pay their assessment in Oregon. And then there's what I'll call the commercial beef producers or ranchers. They pay about two-thirds of the assessment. Now, that's on the beef side. That's not talking on the milk products. I represent the ranchers of Oregon who pay the two-thirds of the beef assessment dollars, and just to save time, I'll say that by the ranchers, by the Oregon Cattlemen Association, support Senate Bill 854A, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And we'll finish up with Dave Nelson and Richard Whitman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson, representing, along with Mike Dewey and John McCauley, the consortium, as Mike described it, of the 28 Commodity Commission supporting Senate Bill 854. A long time ago, early in my lobbying career, and I won't say how long ago that was, but I was told, don't talk your way out of a possible affirmative vote by the committee. I would like to respond very quickly to Representative Close's inquiry about the letter from Mr. Van Leeuwen. And if you would look at this graph, this is a copy of sales charting by a program funded by the Five Grass Seed Commodity Commissions through the Oregon Seed Council. Basically $55,000 a year, leveraged $200,000 a year from the United States Department of Agriculture Foreign Agricultural Service Market Development Program to develop markets in China. And you can see that from the early mid-1990s, 94, 95, actually if you go back to 92, 93, we're selling about 50,000 pounds of grass seed annually to China. In the 01-02 year, that fiscal year, July 1, we sold, according to this set of data, and there are two sets of data, a little over 10 million pounds, which resulted in about $7 million of new income into the state of Oregon from just that one activity. If you turn to the back page, and we're required by the USDA to do a program evaluation periodically that we're required to pay for to see if have the effect of our programs. And this was done by OSU Agricultural and Resource Economics, and they buy a data set that is bills of lading driven on exports of grass seed from Oregon to China. You see that's over 6 million kilos, which is about nearly 13 million pounds of seed now going to China. That's about $10 million in new income into the state of Oregon. So you have one program that equals the total assessments of all of the 28 commissions. That's a very measurable result of the promotional programs of commodity commissions in just one entity. Also, I'd like to point out that I received in the mail the other day a copy of the Dairy Commission Connection, and you see it's just a nice collage of programs that the Oregon Dairy Products Commission sponsors. On page one, milk in McDonald's. That's kind of a unique approach to have something nutritional in McDonald's. On the inside of page two, you see nutrition training in middle school classrooms, and so a variety of other programs. But this kind of activity has resulted in Oregon having the highest individual consumption, per capita consumption of milk, fluid milk in the United States. So we're basically here, I'm here to answer any questions. I think you've been talked at enough. Mr. Whitman can answer any and discuss any of the legal issues that Representative Barnhart may want to readdress, and we're here at your disposal.
Okay. Thank you.
We urge a yes vote.
Oh, okay. Any questions of this panel?
I have one.
All right, Representative Close.
Mr. Nelson, I noticed on your Connection Dairy Farmer sheet that football is not listed. Since I have a son that's a football player, I just wondered why that was. I believe he has one of those black sweatshirts with Dairy Farmer.
Sheldon Pratt, who's the administrator of the Dairy Products Commission, is at the back of the room, and his son Jake plays for the OSU football team, so I imagine there was a conflict of interest there. That's really a winging answer.
Representative Close, I might be able to respond looking at above. It's the spring academic All-State awards. So these are the spring teams.
Well, may I comment that the football award, I believe, went to my son's football team, Sammy and Christian. He is very proud of their black sweatshirts that they have, and it was a very nice.
Well, Mr. Chair, for Representative Close says, I'm a proud grandpa, too, in that my grandson went through Regis High School pitching baseball and went 33-0 in his high school career, and they just won the 2A state championship. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, my 7-year-old grandson started ball, and he is a triple-digit hitter, so let that be on the record.
Why not?
Hey, Mr. Chair, if I can finish. It's very nice that they give these teams these sweatshirts with Dairy Farmers of Oregon on them, and they honor them that way. So I want to thank you.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question about free speech. Oregon has the broadest free speech in the nation. So why, tell me how that plays with this bill, and why they're so concerned about free speech, since we have such broad free speech.
Chair Doyle, Representative Verger, for the record, Richard Whitman, attorney in charge of the Natural Resources section of Department of Justice here. You're right, Representative Verger, that Oregon does have an extremely broad free speech clause in the state constitution. In direct answer to your question, there has been no challenge to these programs under the state constitution at this time. There has been a case brought under the free speech clause of the Oregon Constitution having to do with license plates, and I don't remember the name of the case, but raises some similar issues about free speech and whether people are compelled by certain government actions to speak in a particular way. And we have a holding from the Oregon Court of Appeals that indicates that the Oregon courts are likely to follow the direction of at least some of the federal courts in that if it's the government that's speaking, then the free speech clauses of the Oregon Constitution or the federal Constitution don't apply. The free speech clauses guarantee citizens the right to free speech. They do not guarantee citizens the right to be free of their government speaking. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I think it does.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Representative Moss Anderson.
How are the growers assessed based on what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moss Anderson, there are two basic versions of assessment. One would be something like so many cents per pound of product sold. The assessment is collected by the first purchaser, as in the case of a grass seed company. Grass seed company would deduct that assessment from the grower's settlement check. Another means would be as a value-based or as a percentage of the sale value. The Tall Fescue Commission is an example that has set its assessment at 0.25% of the actual sale price of a pound or ton of grass seed. So if the price goes up or down, the assessment floats with that variation in price from year to year or from pound to pound. So each commission then in turn has a statutory maximum on the amount that can be assessed, generally 1.5% in the absence of any other limitation.
Follow up.
Yes.
Are you aware then of any of these commissions where maybe there are one or two large producers and the rest are very, very small, so it's really one or two growers that are funding primarily the commission?
Probably the closest that I personally know of to that kind of a description would be the bentgrass, the Highland Bentgrass Commission. It's a grass seed, typically a fine turf that's marketed basically to Germany. Dorfler Farms in Sublimity would probably produce close to 50% to 70%. In one year, they did control all of the seed stock of that particular variety. They're one of the twin Dorfler boys is the chairman of the Bentgrass Commission, and very supportive of the commission.
So your feeling is that for those commissions where there is obviously a big discrepancy in the amount they pay into the commissions, that they feel okay about that, even though they're not getting promotion of their own product, which is the bulk of the product from Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moniz Anderson, when most of these commissions were created, they required a double majority, and it was two-thirds of the producers voting in the affirmative, and they must represent 50% of the production of that commodity. So I don't think you could get a tax passed with that kind of a requirement, but the commissions were created. That obviously leaves some room for people who don't want to be part of a group to say, I'm going to go it alone, but at the same time, all of the benefits that we've talked about play into that, and it's simply a decision of the majority that everyone plays because everyone benefits. But there are obviously some who don't want to play.
Further questions? Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have sort of a constitutional question for Mr. Whitman. You know, we have many state commissions that are tax-funded, mm-hmm. and many of those commissions take positions that not all of us agree with, but we still have to fund them with our taxes. So I'd like you to tell me, I understand this is a different situation where you're assessing the members that are paying into the commission, but you still have people paying and you have free speech issues. And so I guess I'm wondering what the difference is. You know, as a taxpayer, I can speak out against what my government does with my taxes, but I still have to pay them.
Chair Doyle, Representative Close. The fact that the U.S. Supreme Court has said under the First Amendment that people's redress, if they don't like what the government is saying, is with their legislature. To go to Congress or to go to the state legislature and get the law changed or get the body that is speaking in the way that the people don't like removed or program eliminated. And because of that ultimate political control, there doesn't need to be the free, that's one of the reasons that free speech clause does not reach government speech as opposed to speech by a private entity. Where programs have run into problems, it's been private programs. It's been bar dues, it's been use of union dues, things like that, where people are compelled, for instance, to pay into a union, which then uses those dues to speak in a particular way. And the court has pretty uniformly struck those types of programs down because they're not governmental, and people are being compelled to fund a particular message.
Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Well, and I may be getting to the point you want to talk about, and if so, just give us your presentation. How is the situation we're talking about now in this bill different than the California State Bar in the case that they lost around these kinds of issues?
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, the key difference is that the California State Bar was found to be not a state governmental entity. And at least for speech purposes, whereas in this situation, we already have an Oregon Court of Appeals decision saying that the assessment funds that are collected are public funds, and as has been said by the panels before you today, the purpose of this bill fundamentally is to ensure that the promotional, the use of those funds for promotional activities by being subject to additional oversight by the Oregon Department of Agriculture is considered to be state speech rather than private speech.
There was a question earlier about these Commodity Commission employees becoming state employees. Can you address that?
Mr. Chair, that was clarified, I believe, in the 1991 session of the legislature when the commissions were granted the option of either hiring people, their administrators or their staff, as state employees, and you have some of those commissions that do have employees who are state employees or are commission employees but are eligible for the health benefits and those kinds of benefits. The majority of the small commissions have contracts with commission administrators such as Mr. McCauley and myself who provide those kinds of administrative services for small associations, and we're not eligible or qualified to become state employees unless we would become full-time employees or qualifying employees in an employer-employee relationship with the commission.
And does this bill change that relationship?
Does not change that section of the statute at all.
Okay. Any further questions? All right. Thank you very much. And that concludes the public testimony, and we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 854 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 854. Representative Forrest?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 854 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Forrest has moved Senate Bill 854 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, colleagues, as I think the testimony indicated, I was not interested in the Dash 7 amendments. It just seemed to complicate things, and as much work as this bill had received on the Senate side, it seemed a lot more efficient and without a lot of consternation if we could just pass it as is without having to go back to the Senate for concurrence. So that's why we're just going as is. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the point of this bill, as I understand it, is to figure out how we can sell these commodities that our farmers grow in Oregon. And how we can continue to improve the product and the farming methods and all those things and so on. And these commissions have been important in that process in the past. If this bill apparently is necessary in order to clarify that these are government agencies and that they do speak for the government when they put out materials like this, and therefore their members don't have the right to say that their freedom of speech is being impinged upon. That's my sense of what this bill is about, except of course for the real reason for the bill, which is so that we can integrate our efforts to sell commodities overseas by bringing these commissions in closer to the Department of Agriculture, which of course is also a very fine reason for a bill like this.
Okay. Further discussion? Representative Beckel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the reasons I've enjoyed being a member of the Rules Committee is that we hear so many interesting and very different issues. And so here's one for me that is new ground, and I've appreciated the depth of the discussion and the good questions from the members. And I'm convinced at this point that Senate Bill 854 is a good bill, and I intend to vote for it. All right, thank you.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chairman, 854 does several things for me. It takes into consideration what we need to do in Oregon in promoting Oregon and Oregon products. And I think we do that better collectively than we do individually. And so I think there's been quite a bit of negotiation. I presume that any of us might like to back out of paying taxes, but it's because all of us have to pay taxes that we're able to run state services. I think that analogy applies here, that everyone needs to pay in so that because everybody benefits. And I think it's a good bill, and it will certainly get my support.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you. I have a unique situation that I need to clarify, and so I am going to cast a no vote with the reservation that I will be a yes vote on the floor. And the reason is I have some producers, growers, in my area, I think the best raspberries and blackberries in the world, and they have actually fresh pick, and they do a lot of promotion and actually ship fresh berries to restaurants in New York. They pick them in the morning, and they're shipped out in a cooler across the nation, all over. And I just need to touch base with them one more time, and so that's just a little red flag. So that's why my no vote, but I will be have a firm probably yes on the floor.
All right, so noted, and there went our consent calendar option. But Representative Barnhart?
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate all of the things that Representative Montefiore said except one, because it is well known, of course, that the best raspberries and blackberries are grown in Lane and in Inland County.
All right. We don't need to talk about cranberries and Coos Bay.
Oh,
but,
I don't know. It's banned.
Actually, yeah. Banned,
not Coos Bay.
That's right.
It's banned.
Pardon me.
Yeah, that's okay.
And same to the Cranberry Commission folks. Further discussion? Seeing none, let's call the roll.
Representative Backman.
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Coos.
Both aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
No.
Aye.
Chair votes aye, and Chair will also carry this bill as well. And Senate Bill 854 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. That closes the work session on Senate Bill 854. And colleagues, we are going to still hear House Memorial 10. We'll do that now. House Memorial 9, however, because of the lateness of the hour, we will hold to another day. And we welcome our main committee administrator, Kara, back for HM 10. And we open up the work session, or public hearing on HM 10, and ask Representative Gray Smith to come forward.
It would be appropriate to bring Mr.
Sure. Sir.
I want to bring Mr. Hudson because you can ask questions that I can.
All right. There's only a couple more people in the audience. They can kind of come around.
I know they all laugh.
Well, the life says one. Everybody's meeting.
Thank you, Chair Doyle, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which includes Union, Wallowa, Umatilla, and Morrow County. About 2 weeks ago, I received an email notifying me that the U.S. Department of Agriculture, particularly within the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service section of USDA, was going to be taking testimony in regards to a very serious issue known as bovine spongiform encephalopathy, mad cow disease. And I read the email with interest and contacted the Oregon Cattlemen's Association and said, what's this mean? And Glenn and I had a short conversation. And I said, you know, rather than having perhaps myself just write a letter to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, I think it would be very appropriate for the Oregon House of Representatives to introduce a memorial to express our concern about this issue and express our support for an industry that's very important to a very large segment of this state. And so I took one of my priority bills after intensive conversation with Chair Doyle, and Chair Doyle, I truly appreciate your leadership in allowing this to come forward. And with Mr. Stonebrink's work, we drafted House Memorial 10, and that's what you have before you. And I'd like to just take a moment and read that to you. We, your memorialists, the House of Representatives of the 72nd Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon, in legislative session assembled, respectfully represent as follows. Whereas the vitality and profitability of the cattle industry in Oregon and the rest of the United States hinges on consumer confidence that they are purchasing safe beef products, and whereas a significant amount of beef produced in the United States is exported, assisting in the viability and profitability of the cattle industry, and whereas beef producers in the United States have been held to extremely high standards, and whereas federal and state animal disease detection and control has created global consumer confidence that United States beef is very safe for consumption, and whereas bovine spongiform encephalopathy has been detected in Canada, causing the United States Department of Agriculture to close the United States border to the importation of Canadian cattle and beef products, and whereas other nations have stopped importing Canadian cattle and beef products due to the detection of bovine spongiform encephalopathy in Canada, and whereas many nations that import cattle and beef products from the United States also import cattle and beef products from Canada, and whereas opening the United States border to the importation of Canadian cattle and beef products before other nations eliminate their concerns about Canadian bovine spongiform encephalopathy could greatly jeopardize United States cattle and beef product exports, now therefore be it resolved by the House of Representatives of the State of Oregon, the members of the House of Representatives of the 72nd Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon encourage the United States Secretary of Agriculture and other federal officials to refrain from opening the United States border to the importation of Canadian cattle and beef products until all other nations eliminate their concerns about bovine spongiform encephalopathy in Canada and are willing to accept Canadian cattle and beef imports. This House Memorial, if approved, will be forwarded to the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, the Majority Leader of the United States Senate, the Speaker of the House of United States House of Representatives, the United States Secretary of Agriculture, and the members of Oregon's congressional delegation. Thank you, Chair Hall.
Thank you. Why don't we go forward with an additional presentation and take questions at the end.
For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink, Executive Director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I think Representative Smith said it all. If it isn't clear, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
and I just call it BSE because I can't pronounce those like I should. And if you really want some technical questions about that, have technical questions, that's why we want Roger Huffman to be here.
Okay. And any comments, Mr. Huffman?
Excuse me, for the record, Roger Huffman with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I'm an administrator of the Animal Health and Identification Division for the department. I guess the only thing I would add to the testimony is that the risk is serious enough, and the causative agent and how it's spread, and those things are of concern enough in the feeding industry that it's not in addition to what was spoken, cattle and cattle products. It's actually all ruminants and ruminant products. As maybe some of you noticed, there's ODFW put out notices for those people are going elk and moose hunting in those in Canada and cannot bring those carcasses back. So it's much broader than even cattle. It's a very serious disease we want to be very careful with.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we understand now pretty well how this disease is spread and what the steps are that are necessary to prevent it spread? Or is it still a quarantine and by guess and by golly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, there's still some questions depending on which species that you're talking about. The whole TSE within the different species, the CWD and deer and elk, for example, versus the BSE. But we're pretty certain that there's very small risk of animals that are in contact with other animals that have this disease contracting it from those animals. And it's primarily thought to be in the feeding of tainted products to these animals. In other words, animals that have died from this disease using that products from those and being fed back to similar animals, or animals that are susceptible to that particular one of the TSEs.
Follow up.
So don't you eradicate this disease by simply not feeding animal parts to these other herbivorous animals?
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, yes. I think what they've toyed with is to not feed known infected animals back to others. So they're taking the further step in the United States and have done to not allow feeding ruminant products back to other ruminants. That's been in effect since 1997. And that actually nationally in Canada, it's been recommended, and even in the United States, just say maybe even better yet to feed no ruminant products to any other animals, period.
Yeah.
So that...
Yeah, it is true, isn't it, that we don't really know how these prions behave, the active agents in this disease, so far as we know, the active agents in this disease. And we don't really understand how they jump species or what the effects are on human beings or other animals. Isn't that the reality of this?
Chair Doyle, that Representative Barnhart, that's true. And in some species, it's even more mysterious than it is with BSE, but clearly in the UK, for example, where there was a large number of animals, they have stopped that reinfection of animals by the discontinued use of those products.
Thank you.
Further questions? All right. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brad Harper, Executive Director of Water for Life. I appreciate the opportunity to address you on this subject. We normally limit our comments to issues dealing with agricultural water rights, but since many of our members are ranchers and this is clearly an important issue for them, we just wanted to thank Representative Smith for introducing this bill and encourage you to pass it.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment and a question for Representative Smith. First of all, Representative, I thank you for bringing this bill to us. Or this actual memorial, excuse me. And secondly, my question is, did you practice for a long time the term encephalopathy?
2.5 hours.
I thought you were very impressive in the reading of the memorial. I just wanted to note that.
All right. Further questions? right, thank you. That was all we had for the public testimony, so we'll close public hearing on HM10, and we will open up a work session on HM10. Let's see, Representative Flores, move HM10 to floor.
I can do that. Mr. Chair, I move HM10 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Memorial 10 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
That's excused.
Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Monis
Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Chair Doyle.
Chair votes aye, and we'll ask Representative Greg Smith to be the carrier of that bill. And with that, we are close with the work session on HM10. And colleagues, we are looking to have a another meeting tomorrow, Wednesday afternoon. We'll cover two issues, I think, and then we will not meet Thursday. And, as you know, we're off on Friday.
Yeah. So. I would note in that context, Mr. Chair, that the Revenue Committee is meeting at 3 o'clock.
Yes.
Okay. Tomorrow.
Okay, perfect. We will be done by then.
Okay.
All right. Very good.
And anticipation of short questions and short answers, we will be done tomorrow by 3. Ready? Nothing further, we are adjourned.